Number 11-5115, Diana Johnson et al., Rubia Muhammad et al., Appellants v. Government of the District of Columbia, and Todd Dillard, individually and officially United States Marshal, D.C. Superior Court. Mr. Claiborne for the appellants, Ms. Merriweather for the appellee, Todd Dillard, and Ms. Anderson for appellee, District of Columbia.
William Claiborne. My name is, may it please the court, my name is William Claiborne. I'm on behalf of appellants who were plaintiffs below. The plaintiffs in this case are women who were arrested on D.C. charges, minor charges, pursuant to D.C. statutes. They were taken pursuant to a D.C. rule of superior court to the superior court for their presentments. And they were strip searched upon arrival at the Superior Court. And they were not held in any kind of general population facility at the courthouse. They were taken directly to a pod for women. All women in that pod were strip searched. And these women, after being strip searched in that pod, were then taken to interview rooms outside of the presentment courtrooms, where they were held by themselves. After their presentments, they were released directly from the courtroom, never went back into any contact with any of the other prisoners in that cell block. And these women, because they'd never been presented before a court, and because they'd been arrested on minor charges, were very likely to be released at presentment. As a matter of fact, the government's own analysis conducted by the GAO of the district's criminal justice system found that virtually all misdemeanants were released on some kind of release at presentment. And plaintiff's expert found that 80% of all women taken to that courtroom were released regardless of the charge. No men were strip searched unless there was some kind of additional finding. The women were just strip searched because they were women. And the reason is, it's such a bad reason that it embarrasses people to talk about it. The reason
I think we know the reason. I'm interested in your theory that the District of Columbia might be somehow liable here. And I'm particularly interested in, I think you call it your entrustment theory. Given the statutes that govern the Marshal of the Superior Court, how can you argue that the district had a choice whether to use Mr. Dillard's services?
Well, Mr. Dillard was made the Congress created a Superior Court Marshal, and that Marshal's purpose was to serve the Superior Court. That Marshal did not have any power to demand from the District of Columbia, the District of Columbia's prisoners. The statute which creates the Marshal, the Superior Court Marshal, and which also created the Marshal Service, does not give the Superior Court Marshal any powers. It doesn't give him any duties. It does outline the powers and duties of the District Court Marshals, but not the Superior Court Marshals. The District Court statutory interpretation was that since the District Court Marshals are obligated to protect federal jurists and court officers, so was Superior Court.
But you have to show under this theory that the district was somehow, I think the key language is deliberately indifferent, right? That they knew that something bad was going on Dillard's watch. And they of their own choice decided to use his services, and that they were free to do that. Is it your position that the law is so clear that they could bypass Dillard? And if that's the case, where's the clarity in the law that you have to rely on?
Well, that's several questions. The district is not entitled to qualified immunity because it's a municipality.
The district, no, I'm talking about your entrustment theory, right?
Well, with respect to the district has assumed functions of the Superior Court Marshal. The district transports, it uses its District of Corrections staff to transport prisoners to and from the Superior, well, from the Superior Courthouse to the jail. And that's a function that, see, here's the thing.
In the jail, they're under, the federal marshal is in charge, correct?
Once they
get there.
I think they're under federal court marshal once they leave the courtroom and they're ordered held pursuant to the pretrial detention statute.
Excuse me. I want to make sure I understand this. During the period of time of these searches that you're challenging, those were done by the U.S. Marshal, right?
I think it has to be a finer distinction.
Really?
These are prisoners who had never been in the jail, had never been handed off to a district court marshal, mm-hmm. who were handed off from the MPD to the Superior Court Marshal, mm-hmm. in the custody of the Superior Court Marshal.
Yes.
So they were never in the Department of Corrections prior to this presentment, nor were they ever in the custody of a district court marshal.
Of the U.S. Marshal?
Correct.
They were in the custody of the U.S. Marshal during the time of these strip searches, no?
Right. Always in the custody prior to presentment, always in the custody of the Superior Court Marshal.
And who is a member of the United States Marshal's office?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. He's certainly not under the control of the United States Marshal Service.
So
United States Marshal Service can't fire him. I mean, the district has made a great deal of hay out of whether or not the Superior Court Marshal is an agent of the District of Columbia. Well, I don't think the Superior Court Marshal is an agent of the United States Marshal Service because he's appointed by the president. He serves at
Dillard's a U.S. Marshal.
That's an interesting question. He is a U.S.
Wasn't he appointed by the president?
That's true.
Okay. And is he by statute under the direction of the Marshal Service?
I don't think that he's an agent of the United States Marshal Service.
What about the answer to Judge Tatel's question? Because I was going to ask the District of Columbia the same question.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question there.
My question is, as I read these statutes, he's appointed by the president, and he serves under the direction the president shall appoint by the consent of the Senate. Okay? So he's appointed by them. And it says, he shall appoint a U.S. Marshal for each district and for the Superior Court of the District of Columbia. That's this guy, right? That's our man.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
In other words.
And then it says, each U.S. Marshal shall be an official of the service and shall serve under the direction of the director.
That's the statutory language. However,
that's what we deal with here.
I beg your pardon?
I said that we live by statutes. That's our job.
But I think there's a conflicting statute.
Okay, let's talk about that. That's a good point. So you want to 566A, right, leaves out the Superior Court, correct?
Leaves out the and I think it leaves out the Superior Court Marshal too.
Yeah, exactly. But it says, quote, it is the primary role, not exclusive, but primary role. And then 566E1A, which you also rely on, it says it authorizes marshals to provide personal protection for federal jurists, right? And you say, well, it doesn't mention Superior Court. But it does say court officers and other threatened persons.
But I think that term court officer.
Where's the ambiguity here?
Well, the court officer is subject to the qualifier federal.
Uh-huh.
Otherwise, the Superior Court Marshal would be able to go across the river into Arlington, Virginia, and demand that the sheriff of Arlington County hand off his or her prisoners to the Superior Court Marshal. Mm-hmm. He could go out anywhere he wanted to go by that interpretation, which I think was the district court's interpretation, which that's why we think it's not a good interpretation. Yeah. But see, that relates to we have two theories for making the district liable. One of them is what we call the organic theory, and that's analogous to the situation where the parole board, the United States Parole Board, at times exercises district functions when it deals with the parole issues of district prisoners. The other theory is the entrustment theory, which is what Judge Griffin was asking about. With respect to the entrustment theory, it does not matter what Todd Dillard's status was as Superior Court Marshal.
And why is that?
Well, here's an example. Mm-hmm. Let's say in the Butera case, which is analogous, the MPD took possession of one of their informants and placed him into a snake pit of a drug den. That person was killed as a result, even though the district MPD did not have authority over the people in that drug house. They took an individual under their custody who had relinquished to them all ability to care for himself, and they put him in a dangerous situation. That's what the entrustment theory is. If I take my prisoners and hand them off to a jail that beats them if they don't get up at 5 a.m., and I know about that, I'm liable because it's my policy and my agents who put my prisoners in that dangerous situation.
But that theory turns on the notion that they had a choice, right? That the district could have chosen to bypass the Superior Court Marshal here, and that gets us back to the statutory issue.
Well, I think three things about that. One is, in our brief, we said it doesn't matter whether the district has a choice. But going back to the statutory issue, I don't think the statutory issue is dispositive because, at least in our...
What do you mean it makes no difference if the district had a choice? If there's a statutory requirement that they turn over the detainees to the marshal of the D.C. Superior Court, Then how can you charge them with deliberate indifference in face of what you claim was going on?
I think the strongest argument in this case is at the time these searches occurred, there was an order of our district court saying that the district did not subject women in this class, that is pre-presentment women arrestees, to strip searches. And so if the district was bound by that court order, so assuming without conceding that the district was obligated to hand these prisoners off or these arrestees off to the Superior Court Marshal, the district at least should have done something. It should have informed the marshal that there was such a restriction on their and his ability to strip search them.
If there was a violation of that court order, that's a consent decree, wasn't it?
Is that a consent decree? It goes by the title consent decree, but nonetheless it's...
Or whatever it is, it's enforceable by the court.
Correct.
So if there was a violation of that, the proper remedy is to enforce that decree. This is a different case.
I don't think that's the exclusive remedy. Mm-hmm. Because the court's question was...
I understand that. That's a good point. You do have this remedy, but I don't understand why the consent decree relates to this case.
I see. I was specifically... I think it does on several issues, mm-hmm. but the question I was answering was if I did not concede this, but I said the question was, what if there was a statute which obligated the district to hand its arrestees off to the Superior Court Marshal? How can the district be liable for doing what it's obligated by statute to do? And I said, because there's a conflicting obligation. And that conflicting obligation is the consent decree, the order of Judge Aubrey that said, do not strip search your female pre-presentment arrestees. Now, what if the case arose this way? What if that order were in place and the MPD or the judges or somebody over there, some lower level person said, look, we're not allowed to strip search these people. It would be a form of rendition. We can't strip search them, but we're going to hand them off to you, and you strip search them. And that way our hands will be clean. I just don't think the law allows for that sort of end run around the consent decree. I think the district is obligated to that.
Why isn't that an issue that could be, that's an interesting point, and it might be a very powerful argument for why the district is violating the consent decree.
Well, I think the question was, why does the district have to do anything? It's a hypothetical question. Why does the district have to do anything if they're obligated to hand off their prisoners to another custodian? And I think that's the answer.
Because I just want to go back to the question Judge Griffith asked you, which is, I'm not quite sure I understand why that theory works unless the district had some authority over what the marshal did, which brings us back to the issue we were talking about before, which is, who does the marshal report to, and does the district have any, does the Superior Court have any responsibility here, or is it all the U.S. Marshals? It seems to me both issues turn on that same question.
Plaintiff's theory, this is just how plaintiffs see it, appellants see it, is that there's two separate theories here. With respect to the entrustment theory, it's not a prerequisite that the district control the person to whom it hands off its prisoners. It may be an issue whether the district has a choice. In our theory, there's nothing in the 566 or 561 which gives the statute that the district court relied on, this court officers, nothing in there gives the Superior Court marshal power over district arrestees.
Can I take you back to your Fourth Amendment claim against?
I just want to follow up just a little bit on this.
Mm-hmm.
The District of Columbia, in its brief, concedes that the language of the statute refers only to federal courts. All right, and then it goes on to say, well, we have this act creating the U.S. Marshal, and we have to look at sort of the legislative intent and structure. And then for control, it relies on an affidavit by the chief judge of the district court, chief judge of the D.C. Superior Court. And that's the only authority I could find.
That's
from the District of Columbia.
That's true, Your Honor, and as a matter of fact,
no statutory provision.
None whatsoever.
We have an affidavit from the chief judge of the Superior Court.
Which the district court did not rely on.
I know, but this is the district's brief before this court.
There is none. See, originally, plaintiffs thought that this statute 11-1729 applied to the Superior Court Marshal because it had applied to the district court marshal, and it says he's got to serve the district. Well, and then we realized, and this was in the alternative in our motion to dismiss and in our summary judgment motion, there is no statute that applies to the Superior Court Marshal. It's interesting. The district says that what obligated them to hand prisoners over to the Superior Court Marshal are these statutes 24204-13, 24-204, I think 14. And these deal with when the DOC hand off prisoners to the district court marshal so that he could take them to the superior court. Well, now the district court marshal doesn't handle prisoners. But there is a case from 1951 which said if the DOC handed its prisoners off to the MPD instead of to the district court marshal, then the MPD was acting as the agent of the Department of Corrections. And so the same thing applies here. There is no statute governing what the Superior Court Marshal is supposed to do. You had to create all these other special statutes authorizing the District Court Marshal to handle Superior Court Marshal prisoners because there was no authorizing statute. So if either in the absence of statutes, the Superior Court Marshal is exercising the administrative powers of the Superior Court, or he's acting as an agent of the MPD, because he got the custody of these prisoners from the MPD. There's nothing in any statute which authorizes or empowers the Superior Court Marshal to protect the Superior Court Marshal. The Superior Court judges are not listed in 566 because that is federal. You know, federal is not repeated.
So Judge Cadle wanted to move to the Fourth Amendment.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. You started out talking about your Fourth Amendment claim.
Right.
And I want to ask you about this court's decision in Bain, which, as I read Bain, like this case, it involved pre-Presentment arrestees who were placed in holding cells with others, and there was a documented record of contraband entering the cell block. So, what's your best argument for distinguishing Bain from this case?
Well, in the Florence case.
Now what about Bain?
Well, it's just that factual nuances are important.
Yes, that's right.
Issues of qualified
immunity. I agree with that.
Okay, Bain did not have before it the detailed factual record, which this court did. First, there's a legal issue. The legal issue in Bain is different from the legal issue in this case with respect to the Fourth Amendment. The legal issue in Bain was, when you take Bell and apply it to intake strip searches, is it or is it not within the rule of Bell to add individualized reasonable suspicion requirement? That is the issue and the only issue that Bain poses and answers. Well, in our case, prior to the summary judgment, at the summary judgment stage, we said that our case stands without this individual reasonable suspicion. We said, okay, you can make categorical judgments. We already had that in the class definition. We said none of our class members were arrested on charges involving guns, violence, or drugs. So we said, yeah, you can make categorical determinations. You do not have to make an individualized, reasonable determination of every single person that goes through that door. That's what the Robinson case said many years ago in the D.C. It said the police can do a full search, pat-down of every arrestee that comes to the station. They don't have to. They can do that on a categorical basis. So, first of all, the legal issue is completely different. Bain was asked to hold the marshal to a much higher standard. The Bain plaintiffs wanted to say that the marshal had to conduct a individualized, reasonable suspicion determination for every single arrestee coming in the door. What we said was, look, these arrestees come with their arrest history fully known based on their fingerprints. They wear wristbands, and the wristbands give the charge. And the marshal's right in the wristband T for traffic and U for U.S. cases. So you already see right here, the marshals see, and it's not difficult to administer. They see who is and who is not somebody charged with a major offense. And so the marshals in this case were just asked to say, all we're saying is if a person is charged with a minor offense, not involving drugs, weapons, or violence, don't strip search them. You can do that on a categorical basis.
But didn't Bain involve arrestees just like that?
But that's not the issue Bain decided. Mm-hmm. The Bain court specifically said, we're not getting into the constitutionality here. We have one single legal question. And see, the Bain panel didn't really interpret Bell. They interpreted Powell. This is a distinction which the Bull court observed in our favor. The Bull court said there's a complete difference between somebody who is held in the holding cells in the San Francisco jail prior to going into general population. And there's actually a case, it's unreported, but the Marshal Service is a party, which says you can't strip search people in a federal court who are protesters. So the Bain court set up the question posed by plaintiffs. Plaintiffs demanded an individual determination. Our plaintiffs don't. Our plaintiffs say, look, based on the likelihood that we're going to get out and that we've been charged with misdemeanors or even traffic offenses, don't strip searches because we're... And see, here's another thing about Bain. BAME is the only case, in a way you can say this, no court has ever held that it's constitutional or a violation or okay under qualified immunity to subject persons, pre-presentment arrestees arrested on minor charges, to subject them to blanket strip searches. No court, including BAME, has ever held that. BAME held erroneously.
Well, but BAME is binding on us.
Yeah. Well, but here's why.
It had a very powerful dissent, but it's binding on us.
Well, we like the dissent, actually. But,
right, yeah, but that's broad did. Language in the majority yeah. opinion. But the question here's is, the how do you get around that? Or well, can you get around it?
Because BAME says that the Superior Court is the same as a general population. However, I was here for the BAME argument. There was nothing in the record in that case to say what was general population.
Right, but the BAME majority took the position that under the Marshall's policy, one of the factors taken into account is the nature of the facility. And this is the same period of time as in the BAME case. And the majority was persuaded that on those grounds, this was, you know, a reasonable exercise of the Marshal's authority.
Well, I think, once again, it has to do with
for purposes of qualified immunity.
It has to do with factual nuances. The in this case, the facts that have to be taken in favor of the plaintiff are that only women were strip searched, and that the only deference this court has to give with respect to deference are the reasons given by the jailers.
Let me just say what I need your response on is BAME rejected the view that a consensus of other circuit courts of appeals would be sufficient here to hold the marshal, to deny the marshal qualified immunity. And basically in Florence, the Supreme Court, through Justice Alito and others said, you know, we're holding open this question that you are asking us now to address. But while you might argue that BAME, that we should not apply the canon of constitutional avoidance, but should go ahead and decide the question so the law is clear, the ultimate question here as to the marshal is qualified immunity. And the protesters in BAME, while they may not have had these wrist bracelets, for all the reasons set out in the facts in BAME, they're not that distinguishable from your plaintiffs, are they?
Well, I think the plaintiffs, well, here's why I think the plaintiffs are different, because in our case, the facts and the records are in the record is that only women were strip searched, and the fact in the record is the reason the women were strip searched is because their bodies are different from men's, and this leads to secreting contraband. Mm-hmm. Now that's what is in the record.
So there's no reference, you're saying, to the nature of the facility? I thought there was a documentation about the nature of the facility, namely the cell block in the Superior Court.
Well, I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, the question, as I understand it, is you want us to decide the Fourth Amendment question.
Yes.
And you're relying on the consensus of all the circuits. And yes. You're saying that in BAME, indeed, the court relied on the 11th and 9th Circuit cases to say that the law was uncertain at the time the Marshall acted. But you're saying in those cases, the 11th and 9th Circuit were joined all the other circuits in saying that for this category of plaintiff, it would be unreasonable, absent some articulable suspicion, to do a strip search.
I understand the question now. I was counsel, one of the counsel in Powell. In the Fulton County Jail, there's an intake area, and people are kept there for days. If you get charged with DUI and you have to do a one-day sentence, that's where you do it, in the intake area. Nobody gets strip searched there unless there's a reason to strip search them. The only people that got strip searched, the people in the Powell class who got strip searched were strip searched on the way into the general population. So regardless of the dicta in Powell, it was a general population case. Now, Bull, actually, the Bain Court created a circuit split with Bull, because Bull specifically, the Ninth Circuit courts interpret Bull as an exception to the consensus rule. They say Bull only applies when somebody goes into the general population. Now, the plaintiffs in Bull were also general population plaintiffs. Bull specifically said our prior holding in ACT UP, which said that you cannot strip search people in a federal courthouse, that remains good law. And we think that's what Florence says. Florence simply said the consensus cases as they exist are not changed one whit by this decision. And
all I'm asking you is, if you were writing the opinion,
yes,
how do you distinguish Bain, where there's very broad language in the majority opinion?
Well, because Bain was not based on factual nuances.
Was not based on what?
The nuances.
Factual nuances?
Correct. Mm-hmm. For example, the analysis of the contraband reports. One of the reports that the Bain Court relied on dealt with the finding of what might have been a pistol barrel on an individual who was entering the courthouse by the front door. Now, what's that got to do with anything that happened in the cell block?
Well, I understand you may disagree with Bain, but the language is there, and we're dealing with a Superior Court cell block.
Well, two things. One, this would be my strongest argument.
Right,
one
what
is,
you said in the brief was Bain was not controlling because it didn't address the Morgan order.
That's one reason.
And secondly, that the Marshall's practices were an exaggerated response to the problems of jail security because the women were segregated from other prisoners.
Absolutely true. Even if, which we disagree, but even if the Superior Court cell block down there is a general population area, these women prisoners were whipped right through it, and they went to pods with other women that had been strip searched, and then they were put in interview rooms out. I don't know if anybody in this court's ever been a lawyer in Superior Court. That's where you go to see the client. And the only people in there are the women who are going to be presented into that C-10 courtroom or the traffic courtroom. They don't have any contact with anybody. And if they're, and 80% of them get released right there from the courtroom. That's one major reason. These prisoners were kept in a different part of the Superior Court. The other part is there was no factual basis, there's no factual record as there is in this case showing what is and isn't a general population. The Bain Court said there's no significance to the fact that in a general population, people are held overnight. Well, in many ways, that's true. It's not that people in a general population are held overnight. It's just these people are always there, and you have to keep them quarantined from sources of contraband. Well, you don't have that problem in the interview rooms, which are off the presentment courtrooms in Superior Court. A, because these are the only people in them, and they're not intermingling with any other prisoners. And the other is they get released right from the courtroom, maybe 80% of the time.
Judge Griffith, did you have any other questions?
I did. I can't find anything in your evidence on the Fifth Amendment claim. I can't find anything in your evidence that survives Iqbal. I mean, what is there showing even that Dillard knew that women were being treated differently than men? That's what you have to show after Iqbal, and I couldn't find anything that you offered.
I think you're right about Iqbal. Iqbal said it's not merely enough that the jailer
right.
knew, well, actually, in that case, the Attorney General knew what deputies were doing. He had to want them to do that. He had
And where's your evidence that Dillard even knew this? He goes to the cell block. In his deposition, he says, "Yeah, I went to the cell block, but I didn't see anything, any disparate treatment going on." You've got the Mitchell deposition, but that doesn't even get the right time period. I can't find anything that survives Iqbal. What am I missing?
Well, just because a defendant denies a fact doesn't mean that he is off the hook. The court can still look to circumstantial evidence. That still survives. The mere fact that, in Iqbal was a pleading case, and the only thing that was pled was that the Attorney General knew what was going on. It wasn't pled that the Attorney General intended what was going on. Now, that does not destroy these Farmer v. Brennan line of cases, which says, and that was a subjective standard too, Iqbal did not destroy the inference created from facts that a person had actual knowledge of a practice.
No, it takes more than actual knowledge. Under Iqbal, it takes not just knowledge,
but purpose.
What's the evidence that, and I agree with you, you could draw an inference from knowledge, I guess, under some circumstances to purpose, but what's the evidence here that would support that?
Well, one thing is the adverse inference created by the fact that Dillard stayed on as Superior Court Marshal for at least 18 months after this lawsuit was filed, and he references policies which say that what his search practices were, and they were not preserved. Another piece of evidence is the agency's position.
What?
The agency, the United States Marshal Service, their position in the Helton-Clifton litigation was that their practice, consistent with the Marshal Service policy, was that we strip search women on a categorical basis, and we only strip search men if there's some reason to give us suspicion that they may be secreting contraband in their underwear. I mean, it's the agency's position. And the agency was defending lawsuits on this basis, and there was email traffic between the FTCA clerk at the Marshal Service and the Todd Dillard's chief deputy, Carl Rowe. And there's testimony that says the only reason that Carl Rowe receives the email is because Dillard doesn't know how to work a computer and he relies on Carl Rowe for his email. And Dillard said, look, if Carl Rowe got an email about this kind of thing, he told me. And Carl Rowe says, and this was a factual finding in the Bain District Court decision, look, if there was litigation dealing with strip searches, as there was, we knew about it.
But knowledge isn't enough.
Well, I think that is true. Iqbal, knowledge
is enough.
So my
question is, I'll just ask it again.
Yes.
What is the best piece of evidence you have
in
the record? What's the best piece of evidence that the defendant not just knew, not just acquiesced, but that he intended these differential strip searches?
Because there's a change in policy and practice in around about 1999. Prior to that point in time, men and women got strip searched on a blanket basis. After that time, only women got strip searched on a blanket basis.
You said policy and practice. Is there evidence that there's a policy? There's certainly evidence, but practice.
Well, Your Honor, with respect to Dillard's policy, he says he had a policy, and he said that when he stopped being the marshal in about 2004, he left, and he left the policy right there on his desk. Well, he was represented by counsel at that time. As a litigant, he had an obligation to preserve it. The agency...
He described that policy in his testimony, didn't he? And wasn't it his description of policy that it made no distinction between men and women?
Well, but that's what he says, but that is not admissible. What's admissible is what the policy says. And if he's the one he and his lawyers were the custodians of that policy because it was evidence in ongoing litigation, then he says, well, you know what, that policy no longer exists, but let me tell you what it says, then that's not enough to carry the day. He was in a small area. Whereas Iqbal, we were dealing with the Attorney General, who never went to the facility. And our contention is if you're in that facility for 3 years, your chief deputy says look, we strip search women but not men. The agency says, consistent with the policy, we strip search women, not men. You can't say you don't know, and you can't say that if you know that for 3 years that you didn't intend it. If you walk in there one day and say, whoa, you people are doing what to the women? Well, now that I know, but there's going to be a new day here. That's Iqbal. But if you go to work there every single day and everybody basically says you strip search women, and here's the strongest piece of evidence that would create the fact issue for the jury. All of these men, including some women, because women assisted in the searches of the men in the search room, they say we never strip searched men unless we had a specific reason. Well, Todd Dillard says all throughout the class period, all throughout my tenure as Superior Court Marshal, from start to finish, I went down and I looked in the search room. I never saw anybody getting strip searched. Now, maybe his lawyers contend that people were hiding, and when they saw him coming, they started ripping clothes off people. But, you know, that's an inference drawn in his favor. The inference drawn in our favor is he says one thing. His testimony is directly contradicted by the people that actually did the searches, so he's not accurately reporting what happened. The district court thought maybe, well, that has to do with his advanced age. Be that as it may, he's still not reporting what he intended. He's still not accurately reporting what he intended.
All right. Why don't we hear from the United States?
Very well, Your Honor.
Thank you. We'll give you a few minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Robin Merriweather. I represent the defendant, retired Marshall Dillard. Marshall Dillard was properly awarded summary judgment by the district court for two reasons. First, as this court held in Bain, it was not clearly established in 2002 and during this class period that the Fourth Amendment would preclude strip searching detainees entering the Superior Court cell block. Second, concerning the equal protection claim, Marshall Dillard intended that men and women both be strip searched.
In your brief, you didn't really separate you didn't really separate the two issues. For the qualified immunity. I didn't understand why you did that. You just mentioned you want us to find that Dillard's entitled to qualified immunity because it wasn't clearly established, right? Is that your view here?
That's our view, mm-hmm. and I should clarify, Your Honor, we believe that the principle of constitutional avoidance mm-hmm. would only require that the court resolve the part of the mm-hmm. qualified immunity analysis mm-hmm. that the court resolved in Bain, which is whether it was clearly established. Because we filed our brief after the class filed their brief, and they went at length into the second question, which is whether this practice is constitutional, we also address that. But it's our position that the narrower question decides this case, which is...
But have you read the Supreme Court's decision in Camaretto?
The Supreme Court's decision in Camaretto?
131 Supreme Court 2020 decided 2011. Talking about this question as to whether or not under Pearson courts should go ahead and decide the first question and not simply only decide the second question of qualified immunity.
We recognize that it is up to your honors to decide how you want to handle the qualified immunity analysis, whether you want to reach both or one. We would submit that given that this is not the case to reach the other issue, which is the merits question of the constitutionality of conducting strip searches, given that we're talking about a practice that's from more than 10 years ago and we're looking back, we think that if the court were to decide now whether searches are constitutional in the cell block, we would have a different record. We would have something that's more recent. So we believe that given how far back we're looking in this case, and given that this court has so clearly resolved the other half of the analysis in Bain, that this would not be the case. But we recognize that it is the province of the court to decide how to handle the qualified immunity analysis. And
were we to reach the first question, what is your position?
Were you to decide whether it is constitutional? It is our position that it is constitutional to conduct strip searches of detainees who are entering the Superior Court cell block, being held in these group cells, as the plaintiffs in this case were, given the institutional concern in history of contraband being introduced because of the security concern.
So you are relying on the contraband. I just want to be clear about that.
Yes. As the court recognized in Bain, which included much of the same record that we have here, there is a documented history of problems of contraband entering the Superior Court cell block. And those problems and that history affects not only the safety of the Marshal Service staff, but the safety of the detainees themselves and the people who are in the cells with them and the courtroom personnel.
Suppose we were to compare the record in Bain versus the record here. I don't remember that there was testimony in Bain, but I may be wrong, about the fact that this contraband problem had really sort of subsided by 1999. And that, in fact, the pat-downs were uncovering whatever was going to be uncovered. It wasn't these strip searches that we're doing.
As I understand the record in BAME, we being Marshall Dillard, not myself personally, included many
your,
of the
your
same...
Your client.
Right. Included many of the same field reports that are here. There were more depositions in this case. We had 62 mm-hmm. depositions. I believe BAME had a more limited pool of testimony. But I would also note that if, as the court recognized, the Supreme Court recognized in Florence, and it's noted in Bell, which involved only one documented incident of contraband, the fact that a policy may have been effective in having a deterrent effect in deterring individuals from bringing the contraband into the detention facility does not mean that there's no constitutional justification for having that search at all.
So I know this is mixing the two, but if they're not strip searching men, then doesn't that undermine the whole rationale?
Only if that were the policy for developing a strip search policy in the cell block, but that was not the policy, which does shift me into the equal protection. Marshall Dillard...
No, I want to stay with the Fourth Amendment for a moment.
Okay.
Was it reasonable... All right, to strip search only a part of the group if the rationale is contraband and facility security. I just need to be clear about that.
It's reasonable to strip search anyone who comes into the cell block. We believe that it would have been reasonable to strip search men and women. And there is testimony, I should note, that men were strip searched, some, not as many as women, but men were strip searched. So,
if there was a reason to do so.
No.
That was a testimony about articulable suspicion here.
No, actually.
A blanket for women, but not for men.
No, that's where the class plaintiffs presented their view of the record, but that's actually not what the record indicates. What's unusual about the cell block is that there was such a large pool of detention officers and deputies who conducted searches of the hundreds of people who came through on a given day. So we don't have a case where we had three people who searched everyone, and those three people can tell you exactly what happened. We had a large pool, 62 of those people, or about 60 of those people, were deposed. And some of the men said that they consistently strip searched men. And some of the men said that they never strip searched men. And some of the men said that they strip searched men when they had time or when there was something else that justified it. So there was not... So the record actually doesn't bear out the assumption that men were never strip searched. In fact, it shows that Mr. Dillard's male subordinates inconsistently followed his gender-neutral policy, which was that everyone should have been strip-searched. And that was the same thing that Marshall Dillard's number two, Chief Rowe, described is what the policy was. Everyone who came into the Superior Court cell block as a detainee during this time period was expected to be strip searched. At the lower levels of the chain of command, that policy was not being consistently implemented. But the expectation on which the policy was based, and that's where we get back to the contraband problem that justifies the policy, was that everyone would be.
So the United States is taking the position that all of these other circuits that have uniformly held so far that strip searching these nonviolent pre-presentment arrestees who are otherwise segregated from people who have already been committed pursuant to a judicial officer determination at presentment are wrong?
So our position would be that any case
was
based on this record, and I don't know what the record was in the cases from the other circuits. I don't know if these other facilities had the volume of people coming in and the history of contraband that we had in the Superior Court cell block. But if they did, and if on that record those circuits found that it was unconstitutional, the government's position is that that would be inconsistent with Bell v. Wolfish, and that Bell does not preclude such searches. And to go briefly back to the other part of our Fourth Amendment argument, there's certainly no clearly established law that holds that.
My question to you was very carefully phrased, because in Bell, the people who were detained pursuant to a decision by a judicial officer. They were not pre-presentment people.
I think there were also material people who were there who were just witnesses in the Bell case.
I don't remember that.
Who were material witnesses for trial.
Was talking about the court was concerned about the intermingling with the committed prisoners where a judicial officer had already determined there was reason to hold them. So, back to my question.
Yes. I think that actually in Powell, I believe Powell is the correct circuit case. The court noted, whether Powell did or not, it's our position that you have, when someone is coming off the street into a detention facility where they're being held with other people in group cells, whether it's pre-presentment or not, there is a danger that they are introducing contraband into your detention facility, especially because contraband can include something, as the Supreme Court noted in Florence, as simple as an ink pen, which, you know, I certainly have on myself today, and anyone coming in would.
Yeah.
And so our position is that the risk of contraband doesn't depend on whether they've appeared before a judicial officer before they come into the detention facility, but instead is the fact that they could be carrying contraband and they're going to be put into a pool of people where there are safety concerns from having them together.
Mr. Claiborne's point that this class is defined as people who are charged for an offense that involves neither drugs nor violence. That's the definition of the class.
That is, and that would be similar to Mr. Florence in the Florence case, who was being charged with an unsubstantiated, as it turns out to have been incorrect, a belief that he was in violation of an outstanding warrant. The type of contraband that you have, there might be a higher suspicion that you would have drugs if you were in on a drug offense. There might be a higher suspicion that you would have a knife if you were in for stabbing someone.
So
but there's still a concern about contraband for anyone who comes in off the street into our custody, they're not being held in handcuffs, they're not being held in separate cells. There's a documented history of contraband coming into this cell block, which primarily deals with the hundreds of people we get are these types of people.
Come to the nation's capital to demonstrate because they will be strip searched automatically.
That's
the result of your answer. So is your answer to Judge Tatel's question that Florence has already decided the question?
Our answer to Judge Tatel's question is that the same concerns that motivated the Supreme Court in Florence and that motivated the Supreme Court in Bell exist independent of whether a person has appeared before a judicial officer.
So even though the Supreme Court said it wasn't deciding this question,
you're
arguing it's been decided?
No, I said that the same concerns that the Supreme Court recognized in Florence as providing a reasonable basis for correction facilities to have a policy apply here. And I would note that the question that the Supreme Court left open in Florence also involved whether people could were being held in separate cells. And this case does not present that, because despite the class's assertion that these women were being put in interview rooms, the record clearly establishes that not only were they brought over in vans together with other people and walked through the cell block, but they were in group cells that were just a few feet across with open bars from where the jail, the people who were coming in from the jail were. So they really were in our cell block's general population.
They could throw things across the hall, that's the evidence.
That they could, but they also were in the cell with other people, and the question reserved by the Alito concurrence.
This case was they were segregated. This class was segregated.
No, that's the argument that is being presented to the court now, but the record does not bear that out. The record indicates that the women were segregated from the men. That is true.
Yeah.
The female search room was around the corner. The female holding areas were around the corner from the male holding areas. But the female detainees, the testimony from the females who did the searches and the marshal personnel who described the cell block, is that there were group cells in the female detention area, and that's where these plaintiffs were held.
But this is after they've gone through the metal detector and the pat-down. Then the men and women are separated for the purpose of strip searching.
And for where they're being held. There is a group female cell. The number of the volume in the cell block, there were more men in the cell block than there were women.
No, that's not
my point. So the women's area was an area around the corner from the area where the female male cells were. Not from other women, no. That's what I'm saying. That's what the record does not substantiate. That is simply a false premise that counsel for the
women. We're talking about the class.
Any other female detainee, they were not being held in individual cells. The record simply doesn't bear that out.
No, I'm not talking individual cells. You're talking individual cells. I'm talking about they came through the metal detector. They had pat-downs by the police department. And then they were separated by sex.
Yes.
All right. For the purpose of conducting the strip searches.
And for detention generally. That's what I was trying to clarify.
There isn't any detention here in the sense of they're being held for presentment.
Yes, but they could come in early in the morning and appear in court in the afternoon. That's what I was trying to clarify, Your Honor. They're being held in these group cells until their time comes up. And then when you get close to the time, they can go to the courtroom and they may pass through an interview room, but for the rest of the time, and it's that time that the marshal is concerned about, they are in the group cells in the female holding area within the cell.
So this policy was abandoned in 2004?
In April of 2003, the marshal service stipulated during this litigation that the policy had been stopped. And if I could briefly, I know that my time...
And I guess my question is, why, if there are all these dangers that are undergirding the reasonableness of the blanket strip searches?
As I understand the record in this case...
Same record, same offenses, same building.
Without disclosing attorney client communications or work product, I can only say that my understanding from the record of this case is that given the existence of litigation concerning the practice and the party's desire to try to pursue settlement and at around that time frame, in light of those facts, the policy was stopped. The concerns did not go away, but a judgment call was made by someone other than Marshall Dillard.
Well, I'm not asking you to violate any of your oaths of office, much less the attorney-client privilege. Let's be clear about that. Now, what we know is that this policy was being upheld as a reasonable search because of, among other things, you said, the nature of the facility.
Yes.
Yet, in April of 2003, the same period, the marshal, for whatever reason, decides to abandon the policy. Are we not to take that into account in determining whether or not these were reasonable
I would say not. That's when the class period ends. What was reasonable before the policy stopped, which is what the class period is, does not turn on what we did after we had been in litigation in two separate lawsuits for at least a year at around the time that settlements were being pursued. So I would say that is not informative of the need for the policy.
And it is interesting, it's a settlement and a policy decision as opposed to a court determination forcing the marshal to change the policy. In any event, I won't pursue that.
Okay. If I could say 30 seconds worth on equal protection.
Of course.
Your Honors, thank you. We believe that Iqbal clearly dictates that in this case, on this record, Marshall Dillard was properly awarded summary judgment on the equal protection claims because there's simply nothing in the record that links any disparity in the lower level employee search practices to any intent or purpose by Marshall Dillard. He simply did not have the discriminatory state of mind that Iqbal requires, and despite conducting dozens of depositions, receiving survey question responses from 132 employees of the cell block,
well,
there's nothing.
We don't have to decide the facts. The only question is whether there's a genuine issue in the record, right?
Right.
And why is it what here is enough? I mean, he testified that he visited the male portion of this and saw that they weren't strip searched. So why isn't that enough for a jury?
Because for a jury, mm-hmm. you would need something to show that he not only knew about it, not only acquiesced in it, but intended that be the practice. So even if, and we disagree with the premise, but even if you were to assume that periodic visits to the cell block gave Marshall Dillard some knowledge that when he was not on times, that at other times and consistently or under majority of the time that male subordinates were not strip searching, and then he could assume that women, because he never went into the female area, that women were, even if you were to assume that he could take that as knowledge that there was something else, that there was something going on, mm-hmm. something was amiss, you don't have any further evidence. And to give this to the jury, you would need something that would support a reasonable inference that that's what he wanted to happen. And we just don't have it for Marshall Dillard in this case.
Any questions?
I'm wondering how you respond to your opponent's point about the adverse inference to be drawn from the fact that there was a written policy. Apparently there was some written policy, and it was never turned over in discovery.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. The written policy in this case is the policy that we produced, which is the nationwide Marshal Service Policy 9925. There's speculation that there would be something other than that, more specific to the Superior Court cell block, but there's no evidence that there is even anything that is missing. And even Mr. Shealy, when he testified more contemporaneously in the Helton and Clifton litigation, when he was asked to identify what was the Marshal Service strip search policy at this time frame, he referenced 9925. So we don't believe that there is a missing policy that would support any kind of adverse inference. And our secondary point would be, even if there were something missing, there's nothing linking that to Marshall Dillard's there's nothing that was in Marshall Dillard's control and custody that he did not turn over. So there would be no basis for drawing the inference against Marshall Dillard himself, even if something were missing. But our primary argument on that is that it's entirely speculative to suggest that there is a missing policy in this case.
So there was no testimony that he said he had a policy and it was on his desk?
There was testimony that there was a policy, but there's testimony that the policy was a copy of 9925, which is what we...
He could have said that, but he said he had a policy, I thought.
Right, but there's testimony from other people who said that the Marshal Service policy was a kind of a compilation of written policies, and the nationwide policies were part of that compilation of policies. So we don't believe that there was something unique to Marshall Dillard that differed in any way from 9925. And I would also add to that that even if Marshall Dillard had himself written something unique or that on his own, the only record evidence of what the content of that policy is would be that it was a gender-neutral policy. So there'd be no basis to assume that not only is there a missing policy, but there's a missing policy that says women should be treated differently than men. And that really gets back to the bigger issue on equal protection, which is just that Marshall Dillard did not intend for women to be treated differently than men. If his policy had been filed, we would have a larger class of men and women who were challenging the Fourth Amendment issue. But on equal protection, he did not have any invidious intent.
So the plaintiffs would have to have some evidence that showed that he had written something that said, hypothetically, because we have so many men coming into the cell block and so few women, and I only have X number of deputies, I've told my deputies, forget the men and just focus on the women.
Or something to that effect, or I think it's more important to search women than men. I think women pose a greater risk than men, something like that. But there simply isn't, and he said fairly emphatically in his deposition that if he had been told that someone believed that women should be strip searched and men should not, he would have fired the person immediately. This just simply does not, this practice does not reflect his intent or how he or even his number two in command believed that people should be searched coming into the cell block.
And so a jury could not find that he was willfully blind to what was going on in his own bailiwick and what his deputy and the other deputies were doing.
Not on this record, but even if they did, for a Fifth Amendment equal protection claim, that wouldn't be enough. For some other types of theories, I realize that there are other constitutional provisions that have a lesser standard of intent and a lesser state of mind requirement, but for purposeful discrimination, that would be simply a spin on knowledge and acquiescence, which Iqbal says is not enough.
So if you close your eyes, that's not purposeful?
That's acquiescence.
Okay.
If your honors have no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll hear from the District of Columbia.
Good morning, your honors. May I please support Stacey Anderson on behalf of the District of Columbia?
Maybe you can help us through this statutory
Certainly.
Scheme.
I think there is statutory authority for the district's position regarding the duties of the United States Marshal. As I outlined in my brief,
First, what statute are you citing for the proposition that the Superior Court Marshal is a U.S. Marshal? I just want to be clear about that.
28 U.S.C. 561, also 566, which outlines the duties of all U.S. Marshals.
So that doesn't help you as to particular marshal, does it?
I disagree, Your Honor. I think it does not say anything specifically about the Superior Court Marshal, you're correct, but it does refer to the United States Marshal's duties with respect to federal jurists. And I think
But your brief says you acknowledge that the statute isn't talking about Superior Court judges.
Correct. It talks about federal jurists, Your Honor, and federal personnel. And I think in this case
You talked about what? What did you just say?
Federal jurists and personnel and witnesses. And so
what does 561 give you?
561 gives me that the Superior Court Marshal is a part of the United States Marshal Service, an official within that service that reports to the Director of the United States Marshal Service, who in turn reports to the Attorney General for the United States, who ultimately reports to the President. The President nominates with the advice and consent of the Senate, the Superior Court Marshal. So under that chain of command, under that statutory authority that creates that position, it's the district's position that the Superior Court Marshal is a federal actor. And interestingly,
so it's 561. That's your case.
561, and then the duties in 566. Yes, Your Honor.
Well, you only get to 566 if he is a U.S. Marshal.
I think clearly he's a U.S. Marshal under the plain terms of 561.
Now, what do you do with 566A?
It does list specifically...
But it doesn't mention the Superior Court.
It does not, Your Honor.
So what do we make of that?
Right. A couple of responses to that. First of all, I think we all begin with the premise that Congress doesn't intend a meaningless act.
That Congress what?
It does not intend a meaningless act, that it doesn't create a position for which there is no duty or function. And interestingly, in this case, the title of the U.S. Marshal at issue here is the United States Marshal for the Superior Court of the District of Columbia.
Well, they kept changing the name on us. Well, that's why wondered about that.
They didn't, Your Honor. There still is a...
I'm looking at statutory language.
Your Honor, there still is a United States Marshal for the District of Columbia. That's the marshal that's in this courthouse today.
That's not Mr. Dillard.
No. He is the United States Marshal for the Superior Court of the District of Columbia.
But that's not what the statutory language is. That's all I'm trying to get at. I was surprised, candidly, that your brief didn't nail this thing down completely. But you really have to do some inferences here with the Home Rule Act and all that sort of thing.
You do, Your Honor. You do. And candidly, there is not a specific statute that says that draws this out clearly. But it is the United States Marshal for the District of Columbia Superior Court. The Article III marshals are defined by their geographical location. So, for example, again, the marshal in the courthouse today is a United States Marshal for the District of Columbia. The reference to the Superior Court, in my mind, conveys congressional intent that U.S. Marshal has a function within the four corners of the building of the Superior Court of the District of Columbia. In looking at the duties, as I begin to discuss, I think that the term federal jurist fairly applies to the Superior Court of the District of Columbia in this context. The Superior Court has all the earmarkings of a federal court for purposes of this statute. It is an Article I court created by Congress. Following Home Rule, Congress has retained the right to legislate with respect to that court. The District of Columbia Council cannot legislate with respect to the organization and jurisdiction of the Superior Court of the District of Columbia. Funding for the court is through a separate Appropriations Act through Congress. Judges of the court are appointed by the President on the advice and consent of the Senate. It has the traditional earmarkings of a federal court. The court need not resolve the ultimate issue of whether the Superior Court is a federal court, but within the confines of this statute, I think it clearly meets that definition. So we have Congress creating the position of the United States Marshal for the Superior Court of the District of Columbia, whose duties include protecting federal jurists. From that, it's the district's position that there is authority for their role that they're performing in the Superior Court, and also the chain of command.
So you agree with counsel that with Mr. Claiborne, that 566A, that the word federal before jurist, that federal modifies every other word in that sense, right?
I think it has to.
You know, okay,
I think
so it, yes. Then and then all right. So then, if it does, and your answer to that, well, that includes Superior Court judges.
Correct.
And how is that again? Tell me that once more. So.
Again, because the Superior Court has the ear. It says federal court. It has the earmarkings of a federal court. It is an Article I court created by Congress. Congress retains the right to legislate with respect to that court. Congress provides appropriations for that court. The appointments for judges in that court are by the President through the advice and consent of the Senate. All typical earmarkings of a federal court. And again, also with the premise that Congress does not
undertake... Elsewhere in the statute, they know how to distinguish between federal courts and superior court.
Yes. That's correct, Your Honor.
Congress retains constitutional authorities in the District of Columbia, period.
Correct. But with respect to the Superior Court, though, it retains a little bit more authority than it does with respect to the executive branch or the council.
Tell the District of Columbia government and council that.
Well, statute says what it says, so I'm bound by that.
Well,
it actually doesn't say what you say.
Exactly.
It says.
Having to read these words into it. That's
statutes,
the whole point.
Statutes say what they say, but this one doesn't say what you say it says.
Yeah.
But it also doesn't say that the Superior Court has any authority over the United States Marshal. And again, looking at the chain of command.
Yeah.
But all you offer is the affidavit from the Chief Judge of the Superior Court.
And also Marshal Dillard, who We offered his interrogatory answers were here clearly indicated that his directives did not come from the Superior Court, but came from his federal superiors. And again, we look at the strip search policy that was just discussed towards the end of the
The problem I'm having sort of with this argument and getting it straight in my own mind, that for some purposes, you want Marshall Dillard to be viewed as part of the U.S. Marshals Service. For other purposes, you want him to be viewed as an official who serves the Superior Court and only the Superior Court, so that if there is a federal court order out, it really doesn't affect what the marshal in the Superior Court is doing, because that's a federal court order. All right? That's why I'm trying to be very careful about how you're defining who this Superior Court marshal is.
Your Honor, I'm sorry. I'm not following your reference to the
I know you're not following.
Instance.
But it's in your brief. You have to make these jumps. All right? And the argument, one of the arguments the plaintiffs make, is that the District of Columbia, which was a party to the Morgan Order, if this is a Superior Court marshal, and the Marshal Service in that federal case agreed not to do something, then if you're going to argue marshal, that you're looking quizzically.
I don't believe that the marshal was a party to the Morgan Order. It was just the district that was a party to that order.
That's right.
And
you're saying that...
I think we're being consistent.
So you're saying he's always a U.S. marshal, and we should just look at him the way... we looked at him in Bain and say that it's a reasonable interpretation of the marshal's policy.
Your Honor, we did not brief the merits, but I think
no,
that
I know,
would be
but I'm
inaccurate.
I'm just trying to understand.
Yes, I think we've been consistent that he is a federal actor for whom the district cannot be, whose actions the district cannot be vicariously liable.
And all U.S. marshals are... This is a question. Are appointed by, nominated,
yes,
and confirmed
yes, not
by
just,
the Senate.
Yes, yes,
right.
So it's all. They're all within it. They're all under the umbrella of the United States Department of Justice, including the Superior Court Marshal.
So, do you think that we can agree with you just on the basis of 561C? Is that enough? The appointment, we shall appoint with the advice and consent of the Senate, and each U.S. Marshal shall be an officer and shall serve under the direction. Is that enough by itself to support your theory of this case?
I think I can get by with that, Your Honor, but I also think we have additional evidence in the
but
case.
But why isn't this enough?
He's a federal act, Your Honor. The district has no authority or control. He reports to...
Yes. Well, why isn't that enough? Why do we have to get into anything else?
Oh, I think it's enough. Yeah, I absolutely do, Your Honor. He is clearly a federal actor. And we have... There is nothing that the plaintiffs have pointed to.
So we don't... To win for you, we don't have to write an opinion saying the District of Columbia is a federal agency?
No.
Okay.
No.
Well, it sounded like that's what you were saying. You were saying, when I answered the question about the word federal before jurist, that included Superior Court judges.
Just in terms of the question of whether or not there's duty specified, that goes to that limited issue. Assuming that there's no duty specified in the statute, it would still be the district's position that the U.S. Marshal is a federal actor. And it would be our position that to the extent there's a void in the statute with respect to the marshals, Superior Court Marshal's duties, that void is to be filled by the Director of the United States Marshal Service, the United States Attorney General, or the President of the United States, not the Superior Court of the District of Columbia. So that was my point with respect to that. That goes really just to whether or not the duties are specified within the statute. But clearly, under the statute, in our mind, the Superior Court Marshal is a federal actor, an employee, who answers to the executive branch of the United States government and not the Superior Court.
Okay.
There are no further questions, Your Honor, we'd ask.
Judge Griffith, did you have any questions?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Counsel for appellants?
Thank you, Your Honor. One point I wanted to highlight was counsel for Defendant Dillard said it was a false premise that female arrestees were segregated in interview rooms. Yeah. So starting on page 14 of our first brief, that's when we lay out record evidence showing that female arrestees, after being strip searched in the female pod, were then taken, held, and segregated in the interview rooms outside of the presentment court.
I thought counsel's point was before their strip search, they are not segregated. I thought that was counsel Merriweather's argument.
Perhaps I misunderstood it. I just wanted to say they were, as Defendant Dillard says, they're taken out of the vans downstairs, mm-hmm. they're hustled all the way up stairs, they're segregated, and then they're taken into these rooms, strip searched, and then put into the interview.
So that's your brief at what page?
Starting at page 14.
Thank you.
And with respect to what Defendant Dillard knew or didn't know or what he wanted, acquiescence after 3 years, I think, matures into intent. And Defendant Dillard never says anywhere where he says there's nothing in the evidence, there's no evidence in the record indicating that Defendant Dillard ever told anybody that he wanted men and women strip searched alike. There's just simply nothing there. The only evidence on the strip search policy is what's in the agency's responses in the Clifton-Helton litigation, and they say that strip searching women but not men is consistent with this Marshal Service policy. So Defendant Dillard says he wanted men and women stripped alike. Chief Rowe says he didn't know how the women or the men were strip searched. Mike Mitchell says we developed a new policy, and Sheely says that they strip search women but not men. So how can your head of the cell block for 3 years, who was corrected, he says, by Mike Mitchell not to strip search men, how can he be strip searching women but not men when the door to the male strip search room is left open, women go in there, not the male search room is left open, women go in there and help with the clothing and so forth. You wouldn't have women in there if men were being strip searched. And how can Dillard, just because he says, I didn't know, but there's nothing to indicate what he did say because he didn't preserve it.
But what about all the testimony from, there's also testimony, I mean, these same deputies you're talking about testified that they developed their own policies.
I'm sorry, they testified?
That they developed their own. They made up their own rules as they went along because Dillard wasn't around.
That's just simply not supported by the record.
But that's what they testified to.
No, that's what their lawyer said about that. Uh-huh. That is not what they said, and there was actually a specific pleading in the district court dealing with that contention. Uh-huh. But let's suppose...
No, go ahead and explain further.
I beg your pardon?
Explain that further.
Well,
Tell me where I should look to see that the brief is misstating this testimony.
It is in our brief,
yeah.
And it was a Landry and Petrel and another officer. One of the Landry was never, there were three officers, and, mm-hmm. and I guess the citation to the record, I don't know what it is in the joint appendix, uh-huh. but it's something like 290 in the district court, and it's a notice of the... I can supply it. But one of these strip search officers that the marshal relies on for that testimony mm-hmm. was not working in the cell block during the class period. And everybody agrees that the policy changed.
Is that clear from the record? Is that clear in the record?
Yes, it is. Said? Yes, because we address it. It's I think it's docket number 290 mm-hmm. in the district court. It is after the summary judgment motions were filed, and there was oral argument, and then each party kind of submitted a summation of what his views are. I actually have it with me.
And they also misstated, they also, in the brief, they inaccurately tell us that this same deputy went on to say that the supervisors put no emphasis on females. They basically made sure that everybody was orally searched. That's also false.
I don't think any male deputy says that. If any male deputy does, he doesn't know what went on in the female search room because no male deputies were in there. Mm-hmm. The other deputy that the defendant Dillard relies on for that testimony is somebody who searched jail cases. The jail cases came up, they were only men, they went into another part of the cell block, they were not strip searched. Everybody agrees with that. That deputy used to work with the jail cases, and for a couple of days he worked with the lockups, that is the arrestees, who were held in another part of the courthouse cell block, and who were simply not strip searched after 1999. Mike Mitchell says, look, we stopped strip searching men in 1999. So it's not like they were supposed to do it and they didn't, but they only did it when Dillard was around to fool Dillard. No, I mean, Mike Mitchell, who was the chief deputy during a period of time, says, look, we stopped strip searching men in 1999. And I said, well, how do you know you stopped strip searching women? And he says, because Detention Officer Hargrove told me so. Detention Officer Hargrove says she never said that. That's what she says in her deposition. Mm-hmm. And she says, we always strip search the women. The DEOs who strip search women, none of them said that they stopped strip searching women.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Thank
we'll you. Take the case under advisement.